This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
More than once, Johnny Gould's Jewish State has circled back to a previous episode with startling new revelations. Back at episode 88, I sat down with my old friend Jonathan Friedland to discuss his latest best-selling book, The Escape Artist, about the young Jewish men who broke out of Auschwitz to warn the world of the horrors within. Their report reached the desks of Roosevelt, Churchill, and the Pope, and they warned Hungary's Admiral Horthy to stop the deportation of the country's Jews to Auschwitz.
He was the regent of Hungary, the de facto ruler, and he had turned a blind eye to, the deportation of 437,000 Jews, more than that actually, from the Hungarian provinces. So Horthy had no problem with handing the Jews of Hungary over to the Nazi occupiers in that spring of 1944. A 56-day killing spree, actually, that was the fastest, you know this thing, the fastest period of Holocaust slaughter in the entire period. Horthy doesn't bat an eyelid, you know, this is happening all around the country. Then, partly through their extraordinary escape, Werber and Wetzler have got the word out through this report, 32-page document, that makes its way hand-to-hand, crossing borders, smuggled in the dead of night secretly. It gets out to different places and ultimately reaches Winston Churchill in London, Franklin Roosevelt in Washington, the Pope in Rome, and it makes it into the press, the world's press. It's only then, when the world's press now know about Auschwitz and what's happening there, thanks to Rudolf Werber and Fred Wetzler's escape, that the Pope, who's known about Auschwitz for longer than that, and Roosevelt, ditto, then write to Admiral Horthy, Miklos Horthy, and say, if you could continue with these deportations of Jews, and, unspoken, if you're on the losing side of the war, anyone involved, including you, will be held to account. At that point, Horthy and the ruling circle in Hungary panic and think, we're going to be going to a war crimes trial. So he then pulls the lever and demands, at that moment, halt the deportations. It happens very quickly. Papal telegram, privately, Pope doesn't make it public. Roosevelt say, you've got to stop these deportations. And Horthy does that on July the 5th, I think, in
1944.
And that moment, 200,000 lives are saved. But I never want to give him the credit.
No.
I say he saved lives. Werber and Wetzler saved
lives. Under duress, under pressure,
self-serving, yeah. Saving his own skin. He finally stops conniving. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
He stops conniving in the slaughter of Hungary's Jews.
Dr. Bea Lefkovich is known to both of us. She's a fellow member of my synagogue, and one Shabbat morning she told me that, rather uniquely, she knew both men, Rudolf Werber and Alfred Wetzler, who was her Uncle Fredo. But the contrasting post-war fortunes of the two men was stark. Rudy lived a metropolitan academic's life in Vancouver, but Fred was trapped behind the Iron Curtain in Czechoslovakia, constrained, ostracized, bullied by the repressive communist regime. Bayer is director of the Refugee Voices Testimony Archive of the Association of Jewish Refugees. She creates and archives Holocaust testimonies. And she's also a director of Sephardi Voices UK. Bea says she spoke to her Uncle Fredo in German, but an Austro-Hungarian German. She says it was special. And it really was. It was the accent of my own maternal grandparents who came from Vienna. A lovely melody, Bea describes it as. And she's right. This is my own grandma Olga Pasana, who I spoke to on cassette in 1984.
When Hitler came to, I was...
You were 29, yeah.
This was 1938 when Hitler came. Mm. And then I was lucky to come to England on a domestic permit. Mm-hmm. I went first from Vienna to Budapest, Mm-hmm. And there I stayed for, I think, 3 weeks. And then from there, on a plane to Prague for one day, from there to England.
So here we are, Jonathan Friedland in conversation with Bea Lefkowitz, the woman who knew both escape artists, Rudolf Werber and Alfred Wetzler.
You and I first encountered each other back in June of 2022, and I was speaking at pretty well the very first event to launch the Escape Artist at JW3, the Jewish Cultural Centre in London. And you slightly astonished me, because when we had questions from the floor, and I think you may have been the first, you got to your feet and said that you knew Rudolf Werber, the man I've written this book, The Escape Artist, all about. And not only that, you also knew the man he escaped with, Alfred Wetzler. And I had met a few people who knew Rudy, because I'd interviewed for in many sessions his teenage sweetheart and first wife, Goethe Verbova, but also his widow, Robin Werber, and a whole lots of colleagues and others. But I hadn't really ever met anybody who had known Fred Wetzler. So just why don't you begin by telling me how you knew both of them?
So obviously, I read that you're going to publish the book, so I was excited, because I do think the story isn't well known and you've brought it out in the public, and I'd like to thank you for that. And thank also, you. Of course, I have to say I met them as a child. That's important, because that reflects the memories I have of them. And it links to my mother. So my mother was Dr. Gertrude Friedman, and she survived the war in hiding in Žilina. She was taken under, there was an uncle called Armin Winter, who was exempt from deportations. The Slovak government deported many, many Jews in 1942, but kept about 10,000 Jews in Slovakia who were economically important. And her uncle, Armin Winter, fell in that category. She didn't, and her family, but that means they went to Žilina and he could help them, and they stayed with him for about 2 years. There was still a Jewish community.
So Žilina, we should say, is in Slovakia, and yeah, it's a provincial town in Slovakia, and it would become quite important for reasons we might get onto in the Rudy story.
Correct. So she was there. She was then 15-year-old. She went to school in Žilina, and surprisingly, you know, after the deportation stopped in 42, they were, you know, it was difficult, but there was a school, there was a youth movement. So my mother in Žilina had actually an okay time. I have photos from that time. So how does it link now to Werber Wetzler? So at some point, her uncle Armin said to her, there are two men in a specific place. I'd like you, Gertie, to bring food to them. And she took a can of, you know, food, which is stacked. There was food in there. And she went to the, it was the Jewish old age home in Žilina, which actually today has a little museum for Werber Wetzler. And she took it and entered a room. And I know all this because actually we went to Žilina and she showed it to me. So I have an idea of the location. And she opened the door and there were these two men. She didn't know who they were, but what she did recall, that they looked at her and really couldn't believe it. They, you know, looked at each other and said, wow, there's still children alive, there is a child still here. And that's what she recalled of that meeting.
So this is your mother,
yeah,
met Fred and Rudy in their hiding place after they'd, yeah, made the escape. This was the place, the significance of this was the place where they poured out this information they had kept and memorized of the killings in Auschwitz, which would become the Werber Wetzler report. And I think they were in the basement of that old people's home, because I visited that place,
yeah,
myself. There is now a plaque. In fact, I was, yes, there the day they unveiled the plaque. And there are rooms in the basement where Rudy and Fred were kept, because they were in hiding.
Are you playing catch-up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests. How about Douglas Murray?
Israel is a rare country in the West in that it does buck many of the trends. I mean, there isn't a fertility rate problem in Israel, for instance, as there is in most European countries. There is a strong feeling of nationhood and of the debts that the country needs to call upon in order to unite its people.
And Hillel Noyer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
Yes, so exactly. It is where they wrote this report and where they were in touch with the Jewish community. So I don't know how instrumental her uncle Armin was. In fact, my mother left the manuscript behind. She died 2 years ago. So I'm working on this manuscript and I want to do something with it. So that's part of it. Don't know what his function was, but the local Jewish community helped him, helped them. And of course, put them in touch, with the other officials. And, you know, there were then the interrogation and all that kind of thing that took place there. And the report was written there, which my mother didn't know anything about. She knew there were these two men and she brought the food to them.
And she was 14, you said?
Yeah, she was born 1929. They escaped in April. So she was actually 15.
She would have just turned 15.
Just turned 15. I don't know exactly the date. We know when they were in Žilina. So from when to when were they in Žilina?
They were there from they crossed into Slovakia on the 21st of April, and they got to Žilina on the 24th, and they were and the report was more or less done by about the 27th, 28th of April.
Yes.
Signed off on around then. So she would have just turned 15. And was she frightened of the? I'm just thinking, because they looked terrible.
No, she didn't report it that way. She reported it. She didn't know. She listened to her uncle and she did, you know, she did what she was told. You think 15. So she just turned 15. She looked small for her age. That I know that. And that's why she was used as a sort of courier in her family. She had an older sister who was 18 and they had to protect the sister. Because, you know, she was beautiful and she attracted attention. And my mother was a sort of boyish character, looked quite small. And that's why she was sort of used as a kind of courier also in other circumstances. So that was her role within the family of four. And important later when they escaped from, you know, Žilina and went into the mountains. But that's another story.
Another story. Did she do this bringing the food in those stacked metal containers? Did she do that more than once?
No. She just
did it one time. Okay.
Just one time. So I don't know exactly who else brought the food. She knew the place and said we went there and she was actually filmed by a film crew. They reconstructed that scene. And at that time, we couldn't get into the basement. So we were in that building filming and they reconstructed it, you know, her coming into that room with the stacked containers. And there are some rushes, you know, in Slovak. I haven't seen them. What you see. Her memory was really that of they couldn't believe it. And then obviously she, you know, she wasn't in touch with them, lost sight. They went along, went to Bratislava, joined the partisans, Rudy and Freddy. And my mother's stories. Then there was the uprising in Banska Bystrica, and they joined that uprising. my mother, her sister, and her parents, and then fled to the mountains, and then had a interesting story of survival, and survived, and ended up towards the end of the war in Zvolen, in an amazing story. They had false papers. They were lucky enough to have false papers, and they survived in Zvolen, renting a room with a Slovak family. And after some time, they had two SS officers who rented another room in the same building. And for months, they lived in that house together, pretending to be Slovak.
Extraordinary.
And they knew, you know, that during these SS officers would go and, you know, kill a lot of people. But anyway, that brings me back to the second part, because then after the war, my mother's cousin married Freddie, Etta Betzler. So she married Freddie, and then obviously, you know, my mother got to know Freddie. And what is interesting, then my mother got married in 1964 in Pieszczany, in one of the few Jewish post-war weddings. And Freddie was her witness at her wedding. So I have his name is on her ketubah, on her wedding certificate, which is interesting. And I have photos of him, of Etta and their daughter Tanya attending the wedding.
And Etta herself, an Auschwitz survivor.
An Auschwitz survivor. You say in your book, you know, that Etta was the cause of that sort of fallout.
Well, in fairness, it was rather Rudy's feelings about Etta.
Yes.
Rudy was suspicious of Etta because he was suspicious of people who survived the Auschwitz. And that's a strange thing to say. But as someone who had been in Auschwitz, he always wondered what had this person done in order to survive. And so I don't think it was that Etta did something wrong or bad in the relationship between the three of them. It was merely, as I understand it, the fact that she had survived aroused Rudy's suspicion.
Yes. I don't know. And I was in Slovakia recently and spoke to somebody about that. And again, I think it's not clear.
But it meant by amazing coincidence that your mother, having seen these two when she was just 15 and they had just escaped, she then, one of them marries into her family, which is an amazing coincidence. But I suppose the Slovak Jewish community was so small that things like that did happen, where people, cousins, knew other people, etc. It was a tiny community before the Holocaust, let alone afterwards. We're talking in this just a few thousand people.
Well, there were 80,000 Jews in Slovakia pre-war, so, you know, not so small. My mother came from Pieszczany, which had a very small, there were about 1,500 Jews in Pieszczany. Bratislava was a bigger community. But yeah, she was close to them because also I think she babysat the daughter. So I know she was close to the daughter. And the daughter later came to stay with us as well. You know, so they had a close relationship.
The best guests and their most heartfelt views, a relay of their missions to a worldwide audience. 100 episodes along, and I'm proud that it's fast become the podcast of record. This is coverage of the Jewish and Israeli worlds that just doesn't get properly aired in mass media, and I'm not ashamed to ask for your help. A one-off donation is always gratefully received to support my efforts, but a monthly donation really gets our service off the ground. Your donation can also be made with Gift Aid, and it's so easy to do. Just click on this, donorbox.org/JG podcast. That's donorbox.org/JG podcast. Are you in? Please share my series with your friends, and thank you for listening.
So let's bring it to when you met Fred, and then you'll tell me about meeting Rudy.
Yeah, so I should say something about myself. So I grew up in Germany as a daughter of two survivors because my parents emigrated to Germany in the 60s. My father actually in 58, my mother in 1964 after she married my father. And that is to really escape from communism. They had a hard time my mother and my father. So they escaped and settled in Germany. So the interesting bit is I was always aware of the Holocaust. I knew my parents are survivors. They talked about it, not in detail. We certainly didn't talk to our friends, to our other Jewish friends in detail about our parents' experience. We all knew there are survivors. It wasn't a secret. But my mother had lots of friends who were survivors. So one of them was Rudy, and I'll tell you a little bit about how I met Rudy. And of course, I knew about Vetsa. I knew that they had escaped. I'd heard the story. So I was very, very lucky that I managed or decided that I would like to go to Bratislava. And in the winter of 88, I decided I should visit them. And I went with a friend to Bratislava, and we stayed with them for about a week in their flat in Bratislava. And I have a diary, and I just looked at my diary. I found my diary. And, you know, I say it was so interesting that they still live in the world of Auschwitz. The world of Auschwitz was still there. They talked about it. She talked about it. He talked about it. They had a hard time because Fredo wrote that book. He had to write it in the third person. He had problems with the Communist Party. The money was cut because of that's what they told me at the time. Because the report was sent to the papal nuncius, that was a problem in post-war Slovakia, because they kind of said it was a religious, that it wasn't socialist. They made this a problem for Freddy. And he lost his job. And as you know, he then ended up working in a library. So
what was the job he lost?
I think he was a journalist.
Yes, I that's what I think too. When you wrote this very perceptive thing in your diary that they still live in the world of Auschwitz, how old were you then in that week when you spent time with them?
I was 23, 1980. I'm looking here. Look, this is my diary. I can show it to you.
You're holding a green exercise book.
It's an exercise book. It's written, I wrote the entry in January 88. But I think it was a visit over New Year's. So it was probably the beginning of January 88.
And right.
Before he died.
Yes, he died in 88, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think somewhere I read that he died in 87, but this is proof that it was 88.
It's proof it was 88. I think it was a month before he died, because I write then that I feel so lucky that we visited them.
He'd lost his job, which had been, you think, as a journalist.
Yeah.
And was now, when you were there, he was working in a library.
You know, I can quote you here.
Yes, please.
It's a journey. This is a journey into history, into the history of my family. The concentration camp is part of daily life. You know, the television is on in the background, but Freddie is talking about his escape. Etta is talking about the Kapos in Auschwitz. The underlying gist is that it's so very present.
Yeah.
And they talk about, their life in the camp. And, you know, when they talk about other people, they talk about this one was in the camp, this one wasn't in the camp. So it was very, very, very present. What I do write about, one other entry, is that they are not, there's no hatred towards Germans. And I found that, you know, noticeable, that there is no hatred.
What language did you speak with them in? Was it German?
German.
Yeah.
My entry, I'm translating now while I'm reading this.
But the language you spoke to them in was German, Fred and Etta.
Yes, and I should say is their German was this wonderful Austro-Hungarian German. Ah. You know, there's a specific, for me, it's my family, that's the sound I grew up with. It's German, but it's not, Freddy's German wasn't flawless at all. Actually, for him, it was not his first language, for sure not, because right. I to his, you might have listened to that interview recording in the Auschwitz process. Have you ever listened to it? It's painful because the judge was absolutely mean to him. And you can say he's struggling with the German.
Right.
So it wasn't his, but Etta's German was excellent. So they all, my mother spoke German, you know, they grew up with German, but it's this specific, wonderful Austro-Hungarian German, which is not Austrian German. It's a specific accent, you know.
And does it sound quite archaic?
It didn't sound archaic to me. I grew up with it, you know?
Right? But and just
it has a sort of lovely melody.
You said that Freddie talked about the escape. Do you remember what he said about it?
I didn't discuss it. You know, I don't think we discussed it in that detail. He talked about here that he was excluded. He was accused of being a spy for the Pope, like a, you know, yeah. And that he was excluded from the party. I mean, that was a big thing, you know, to be excluded from the Communist Party.
And that's big on the grounds that the report had been sent to the papal nuncio.
Yes, that's what I gathered at the time. But, you know.
And therefore, the authorities, the communist authorities, tried to depict him as an agent of the Catholic Church.
Correct.
Yeah.
This is according to my entry. You know, that's what he said. And that he, more importantly, also that they got some reparations. Maybe there was some sort of pension from the Czech government, Czechoslovak government, for survivors or for partisans. Probably, you know, because he was a partisan as well. And that was cut. The main thing I recall was really Auschwitz was everywhere. It was there. And I understood that he was excluded partly from normal life, let's say, in Czechoslovakia. So he had to take on that job. And I even felt then that his story was not heard. You know, I think, you know, obviously you wrote the book, you had so much material on Werber, but you know, Wetzlar, there isn't so much material. So
no.
I know there's a film is being made now. People are trying to do all kinds of things.
But some accounts speak of him in these, especially towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
You know, there is one book that describes him as dying bitter, drunk, and alone. What was the impression you got of him in that?
Yeah,
in that
so, period? You know, I read that in your book. And, you know, I have to say I found it, of course, disturbing because I knew him. I don't think that was not my impression. And when I was in Slovakia, I went to a conference recently. I gave a paper and I talked to people who knew him. And that was not, I asked specifically about the alcohol because I never heard that. And that nobody could corroborate that. Mm. So I don't think that's true, that the alcohol aspect. Bitter, you know, sure, there was a certain amount of bitterness, but I think my impression is not only that, you know. I think, you know, they were very proud of their daughter, Tanya. She was a doctor. She was very successful. Sadly, she died some years ago. So that's another reason why this story, why, you know, she would have a lot of information. Sadly, I didn't interview her. I don't think anyone interviewed her. It would be really interesting to grow up with, you know, with parents like that. They were very, but they were close to her. They were proud of her. She traveled quite a bit. She came to stay with us in Germany. Tanya, she was a doctor. She worked also in Vienna, you know, so there was that aspect. I know their house was a meeting place for many other people. Their flat, even now, talk about it. So the alcoholism, I think, as I said, I don't know, there is that one source, I don't know who that source is, but that I didn't know about it in the family. Nobody ever spoke about that.
Yeah, it appears in the book by Ruth Lynn, Escaping Auschwitz, but those are the words that appear in that book. And when I said bitter, partly again, and this is in my book, there is this suggestion that there was real tension between the two of them, Werber and Wetzler, for reasons I describe in the book, but also that there was, particularly on Fred's part, Alfred Wetzler, that he resented what I would consider the rather small amount of attention that Werber got, but it was more than he got. And therefore, can you tell me what if you picked up anything about that?
Yes, sure. There was the issue, you know, that there was, you know, something happened between them. And I think Fredo felt that when Werber talked, he excluded him. I mean, I think, you know, that was a very strong feeling. And I think in that book, which I think on Fredo's part, he felt he didn't exclude Werber, but that Werber excluded Freddy from his story or focused on.
You call him Fredo sometimes.
Fredo, yeah. We call him Fredo.
Yeah. But he felt he always was careful to recognize Verba, yeah. That Verba did not return the compliment, as it were.
I think so. And, you know, it relates to the fact that the question is obviously, you know, that is a big question. Who had the initiative? Who planned this? You know, who was who in that? In my interview with Greta Verba, I asked her about this. And she said, oh, they were friends and they planned this together and they knew each other from Trnava. But, you know, I was in Slovakia recently and I asked this question. And that there's a filmmaker, Robert Kirchhoff, and he told me, and he's done lots of research. So he said, and I don't know whether you heard that story, that this, when the escape was planned, that it wasn't Vrba who was to be the second candidate. It was somebody else. Something happened, and then Vrba took the place of the other person. So it was always to be Freddy. And then a second person.
Yeah, Rudy was really emphatic that this was not true. He knew this version of events was out there. He addressed it. I mean, this was the view that this had been planned by the underground, and the underground chose who was going to go. And Rudy said that there was, quote, no mythical committee in Auschwitz, unquote, that decided these things. So, but you're absolutely right. These two different versions of the story are out there.
Jonathan, it's not my source. It's that. Who's talked to a lot of people. So that's what he says.
Yes. I
have to do more research on this.
No, one. Sure.
But I think that was the cause of it. The cause really, I think, according to Freddie, was that, you know, I think they felt excluded. And also they felt, you know, he had more powerful tools at his hands because he was in the West. He was a university professor. He spoke English. And of course, that wasn't available, you know, to Freddie. So, and that brings me now to Verba, who was a friend of my mother. So him, we visited in Canada. I was about 9 or 10 years old. We had a wonderful time with him and Robin. And I remember him, you know, he was glamorous. He was a very good speaker. He, you know, he liked my mother. My mother was close to them. And we had a wonderful time in Vancouver. But at that time, obviously, I didn't understand anything. I was too young. He then also came to visit us in France. And again, I remember sitting with him in a cafe. In his sort of, he had a very dapper white linen suit, and he was wearing a sort of hat, and you know, he was that sort of very, yeah, with a lot of joie de vivre and enjoying his coffee. That's what I remember. But you know, recollections of a 10-year-old.
How come they were friends? How come they were in touch at all? Your mother and him.
I think they all studied together. My mother studied in the 50s. She studied medicine and then dentistry. And Rudy was in Prague and Greta Vrba, they were all in Prague together. So I think she knew him from Prague.
Right. It wasn't that what I was expecting you to say was that somehow she had tracked him down because of that moment in Žilina with bringing the food. But no, they actually knew each other in a way separate from that by meeting in that small Jewish world in Prague post-war.
Correct. I think at that time, you know, in the 50s, they were not thinking of the past. They were thinking of the future. They were studying. They were young. You know, they were in Prague together for 3 or 4 years. And she recalled also Greta Vrbova. They met later here in London and they knew each other. My mother's called Greta as well. So
yes. Can you describe very powerfully that in being around Freddie and Etta, Auschwitz was present all the time. Yeah. I know your impression, then you were 23, but your impressions as a 10-year-old of Rudy, did it feel that Auschwitz was around all the time with him, or maybe you were too young to tell?
No, certainly not. I was young, but also, you know, my impressions, we went to Canada, it was all exciting. I remember Vancouver, it was beautiful. You know, Robin, his glamorous young wife. No, that was not, I don't recall any conversations. But again, I was young. Then later, when he came to visit us in France, there were also, my mother was also in touch with there were two other escapees. And I know my mother was in touch with them as well. And I remember one visit to, I think it was Mordovic.
Wow.
You know, so it was a close, you know, a small, as you said, it was close-knit community it was important for people to be in touch.
Did you meet him again after being 10 years old?
We had some sort of meeting in south of France, and I think maybe even in Germany he came to visit us. So, you know, we were in touch, and I saw Robin, my mother. We went to, you know, there's this Vrba Wetzlar March.
Yes.
And my mother went a few years ago. We met the people in Žilina in the synagogue, and Robin was there.
Yes.
So that's the last time we saw Robin.
But your impressions of Rudy were the impressions of a child, because you were young, maybe a teenager in France or whatever, but you saw him. That little pen portrait you could sketch there of glamour and dapper and the linen suit, just give me an impression of, because we didn't do that, of what kind of man Freddie was. I mean, we talked about the atmosphere in the apartment, but can you sketch for me what he was like?
Well, you know, it's sort of such a contrast to this Vancouver thing. It's the, you know, again, I can't, maybe I have some photos somewhere. It was the flat. I remember the sort of rather darkish gray. I mean, Bratislava was gray. The first one, when I arrived in Bratislava, we didn't stay with them immediately. We stayed in Petržalska, which is a sort of, you know, communist high rises built, horrible gray. I mean, it was gray. Everything was gray at that time in Bratislava. And that was also, I found, you know, that was my memories is dark and gray. And I mean, Freddie had a wonderful, lovely face, actually. I remember him fondly. And he was a very gentle man, gentle soul, quite softly spoken, you know. But the whole thing, it was winter, it was cold, you know, it was gray.
So those are my oppressive atmosphere, if you're the way you're describing it.
Oppressive. I don't know. I mean, as I said, it was, you know, and I've interviewed so many survivors since. So I know, you know, the survivors, the chronology of time isn't that Auschwitz is there, the trauma is there, and that's exactly what it was.
But superficially, you would think, and I know this is superficial, but in a way, the presence of Auschwitz feels more obvious superficially in the Fred Wetzler case than Rudy, because Rudy's dashing and glamorous and full of life. And in these colourful places, Vancouver and visiting you in cafes and everything. Whereas what you're describing is quite a heavy, grey, drab context that Fred was in those last years.
For sure. And difficult, you know, they had a difficult, he felt he wasn't hurt. I think financially, probably it wasn't easy for them to be in communist Bratislava. That wasn't easy either, you know. Mm. So I think the circumstances were much more difficult.
Now, you've given me a very good sketch of both men, actually.
Freddie, on the one hand, his situation was difficult, but he wasn't angry. So, you know, I write explicitly that they were not angry with the Germans. I should also say that. While Freddie was quiet, Etta was very, you know, she was fun and loud and talked a lot. And, you know, there was a lot of, I don't know whether Freddie smoked, Etta, they smoked. So the house was also quite heavy, loaded with cigarettes. You know, so it wasn't, well, it was, you know, Bratislava was gray and the flat. There were lots of people also coming in. I remember they had lots of visitors. There was lots of talking, as I said, particularly Etta. She was a language teacher, so she had students also coming to the flat.
And she was talkative. It was Fred, that was quieter.
Yeah.
And as you say, sort of gentle and quiet.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And do you know what, was it clear to everyone that he was dying at the time or not?
I don't think so. I just found my entry now, and I wrote, on the 8th of February 88 that he passed away 1 month after our return. And I'm so happy that I managed to see him. And I said, otherwise for me this would have been only a name, a silhouette, a shadow. So, you know, I realized that was important, you know, for history probably, but also for our family. I didn't know at the time that he actually was my mother's witness at the wedding. Mm-hmm. I just found recently the document.
Your diary is very poetically written.
Yeah, well, interestingly, you know, I was interested in history. You know, I studied history at university, so maybe by 23 I was probably interested in that aspect as well.
So when you saw Fred, did he ask about Rudy, because you had seen him too? Was he interested in hearing what you had to say about him? Because he probably hadn't seen it for years and years.
You know, I don't know whether we actually even asked what happened there. I don't recall that.
No.
It must have been a very sad thing for them, you know. I can imagine, you know, and probably they felt sort of powerless to do something about it. And I know that in Slovakia, people feel, you know, here's the sort of Slovak story, someone who stayed and did it, and, you know, that story needs to be told. And, you know, I was recently, as I said, at the conference in Slovakia, I gave a paper about the story of, in our archive, Refugee Voices, we have the story of four Slovak women. One of them is my mother, two others. And weirdly enough, out of the four, three are linked to Vrba Vetsla. So my mother, who brought them the thing, and later then Gata Vrbova, because she was married to Rudy. And then another third one came out in the Kastner transport. So the Kastner story is, of course, linked to the Vrba Vetsla report.
Of course.
It's interesting. And the fourth one is somebody who left as a young child from Bratislava. You know, so it's a refugee story. So yeah. Anyway.
You mentioned, which is fantastic, that Rudy and Fred couldn't believe that a child was still alive. And that was a very strong impression your mother got. How did that disbelief express itself?
They said it to each other. One said to another, it's unbelievable. I mean, you have to think, they spent 2 years in Auschwitz. And if you think about, I think that makes this Slovak Jewish situation so incredible. And I can say that from looking at my mother's personal archive, that within a distance of 112 miles, or, you know, whatever that distance is from, let's say, Žilina to Auschwitz, and Žilina was a, that you had Jews being incarcerated and killed in camps. And on the other hand, you had people who was, there was still an official, you know, Jewish community. My uncle Armin Winter was there as Armin Winter. My mother, they had false names and false identities, but actually in Žilina, I'm not sure they used it. They used it later in their survival. And they had a youth movement, you know, a Jewish youth movement. So that reality of that Slovak Jewish history, that is really interesting. Back to the uprising.
Yeah.
You know, the Slovak uprising, which happened in August 1944 and lasted about 2 months before the Germans came and quashed it, that was, unfortunately for the Jews, a tragedy, because then all the remaining Jews, most of them, were killed.
Mm.
But all deported then.
Hmm.
You know, and very few survived. But until 1944, there were still, according to what I know, about 10,000 Jews in Slovakia.
In that moment you describe, it wasn't that they were speaking to her, they were saying, noting to each other, Rudy to Fred, yeah. Fred to Rudy, it's unbelievable that a child is still alive here, just,
yeah.
as you say, 100 odd miles away from the pits of hell in Auschwitz. Yeah. It's sort of an incredible thing.
Yeah, and that my mom looked younger than 15, so they thought she's a young child, and
yes,
they couldn't believe it. And their reality, obviously, you know, from Auschwitz to coming to Žilina, where they must have met, I don't know who else they met, other Jews who were free, not, you know, free-ish.
Yeah.
So yeah, that must have been you know, for them,
mind blowing, really.
Quite something.
Before we leave this then and wrap it up, as I said at the start, you're one of the very few people who met both of them. Admittedly, you met one when you were not much more than a child. You met the other as a very young woman, but perceptive and writer of a diary. Is there anything in your that you've left out yet or still to say about these two men, your impressions of them, the story of them?
I'm doing some more research. I'm very keen to find out more about Vetsla, that I can, you know, have more details to get a fuller picture. But also I think, you know, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about, is how, you know, whether you think there could be some more recognition. And, you know, there's this whole issue of Jewish saviors, you know, how can Jewish saviors be recognized? And I think they did was very courageous. You know, it doesn't matter how many people they saved or not, they did save a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I would be very interested maybe to think with you, you know, what we can do, you know, that maybe they could gain some official recognition.
Yes,
some-
I know. I think very much the purpose of me writing The Escape Artist was for Rudy's part of the story to at least get recognition and to bring his name to people who haven't heard it. And I think it is bit by bit doing that. I think that would be wonderful. I really hope a Slovak writer will do that for the story, or a Slovak speaking writer, and maybe that's you, will do that for Fred Vetslin. Because the problem I encountered, and the reason why it was impossible to write a book about both of them, is, as you said, because Fred didn't speak English, and because also that terribly tragic fate, which actually befell both of them, of their children not living long, Fred and Rudy, it meant there weren't people around really for me. There was just not the wealth of documentary evidence there was for Rudy. And you mentioned earlier the problem of the memoir. I mean, that Rudy was able to write a memoir and as nonfiction in his own name and with that degree of clarity. And Fred, because of the pressures that you've described in communist era Czechoslovakia, had to disguise it as a novel under a pseudonym, which just meant it was not really a reliable, well, not reliable is the wrong word, but it wasn't a source I could lean on for a nonfiction book. Yeah.
I understand your limitations in that way. And that's why I'm sure that I have heard now that there is a lengthy interview with Vetslin somewhere. So it would be really interesting to get hold of it.
I think I know what you mean there. And I came across a filmmaker in Slovakia who has those tapes, and it was a long, many hours of interview that was filmed, if we're talking about the same thing. Again, I think it was in Slovak, and I approached the filmmaker essentially to say, well, look, would you let me have access to these? And I think he was feeling that he wanted to make his film first, but the trouble is that's proved to be a very long process. I think that film has been years, if not maybe more than 10 years in the making. And I think the filmmaker is keen to do something that won't be a straight sort of linear documentary, but something more kind of artistic. And therefore, so that also was something of a roadblock I hit there as well. But I think this is a task for a Slovak writer. I think it'd be wonderful if someone takes it on.
I was at this conference at the, you know, that Museum of the National Uprising in Banská Bystrica. And, you know, I think there is more interest in Jewish history, and obviously that's a proud part of the Slovak Jewish history is this escape story. So I think, you know, people are proud of it, and there should be more information. My Slovak isn't, I speak a bit of Slovak, but isn't good enough to do that. But as you said, I think hopefully there will be somebody who can find more sources to sort of rehabilitate or to bring that voice out, because I do feel it's a sort of silenced voice. And in hindsight, I should have sat down. You know, I'm an oral historian, but I started it just slightly later when I was 24, 25. Now I think, why didn't I sit down? You know, I had the language. You know, I could have just done an interview, but, you know, I didn't.
And is one of the great regrets. I mean, he did do the filmed interview we've heard about. He did do this interview with the State Museum of Auschwitz in 1963, which was very useful for me. It was a very useful source, but it wasn't, you know, it was 60 years ago. It wasn't done in the way we would now do an interview. I mean, it was quite brief, whereas now, you know, it would be, I mean, a story like he had to tell. You really wanted somebody to sit down and interview him for 3 or 4 hours and get it all down in the way that Claude Lanzmann did with Rudolf Werber. Bea, thank you very much for this. I think
nice to talk to you.
It's wonderful to talk to you. I think we've got an insight into both men, and I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Johnny Gould's Jewish State is brought to you with Dangor Education.